The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at kcnr1460.com. Join Sue McClain weekday mornings from 6 to 7 for the Sue McClain News Hour, where you'll hear the up-to-the-minute local news, national and international news, weather, sports, and a whole lot more. Followed by Free Fire Radio from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. with Carl and Linda Bach. From 9 to noon, be informed and laugh along with Armstrong and Getty, equal opportunity critics. From noon to 3, learn how to get out of debt with Dave Ramsey. From 3 to 6, don't miss constitutional expert Mark Levin. Monday through Thursday night, starting at 6 p.m., we have local shows featuring everything from the paranormal, local history, North State Now, and unsung heroes of our area. From 7 to 9, tune in to Ben Shapiro, your local downtown radio station, KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at kcnr1460.com.
North State Now is a magazine formatted show at 6 p.m. every Thursday night. The first Thursday is yours truly, Linda Bott, featuring what's going on in our town. The second Thursday is hosted by Michelle Slade, featuring heroes of the North State. The third Thursday is hosted by none other than James Masada and Rhonda Alvey from Enjoy the Magazine and Enjoy the Store. Our newest edition is the fourth Thursday of the month, Women of Vision. That's North State Now, Thursday at 6 p.m., also streaming on KCNR 14. 60.com.
Premier, your friendly old change. Premier in all we do.
Fall sometimes brings us smoke and ash. This is one of those years, and the health of you and your car is very important. At Premier Oil Change, our 30-point certified service will not only check the fluids in your vehicle, but will make sure to reach the areas that ash, soot, and smoke can tax, like your engine's air filter. We also check your in-cabin air filter to help the quality of air that your family breathes. This is all part of our comprehensive 30-point certified service. Services require no appointment. Wait in the comfort of your own car with free Wi-Fi and beverage. Don't forget about Premier Oil Change Rewards Program. You earn points for every dollar you spend. Add to that, free fluid top-offs. Now that's service. Learn more at PremierOilChange.com. Located in the Holiday Market Shopping Center or in Reading on Lake Boulevard, next to Waterworks Park, or our newest location in Anderson, across from Round Table Pizza. All three locations, you get a free car wash with every oil change. Premier Oil Change, home of the friendly oil change.
100 years ago, Simpson University began with a promise to be the gateway to world service. 30 years ago, we moved to Reading with a promise to serve the North State, graduating professionals who live and serve our growing community. Today, Simpson University continues to provide a Christ-centered education, graduating students with mature and infectious faith, critical competence, and a ready spirit to thrive as servant leaders around the world and at our backyard. Learn more about Reading's hometown university at simpsonu.edu.
Hi, this is Mark from Haven Humane Society. It has been a challenging couple of years, and through it all, our amazing team has continued to save lives. We have so many fantastic animals that are looking for their forever homes, and with adoption fees so low, now is the time to add to your family. With puppies, kittens, dogs, cats, and so many more, we have the perfect addition. Come join our team as a volunteer and help in an area that works for you. Walking dogs, socializing cats, helping in our veterinary hospital, or folding laundry. We have many opportunities and welcome all volunteers. For more information, please visit our website at havenhumane.org or follow us on Facebook. On behalf of the entire Haven team, thank you for all of your continued support as together we get closer every day to North State with no more homeless pets.
Hi, this is Chuck Kenny with Shasta Gas Propane. It's been a while since I've cut a new radio spot, but I feel I need to issue a warning about energy prices during this fall winter of 2021 and 22. Just as Obama said after he was elected, elections have consequences. This winter, our country will suffer some of the consequences of the last election. I'm not a politician, but I am a businessman, and many of the decisions of this current administration will drastically affect energy prices this winter and going forward. Already we are experiencing record high propane costs and prices. Remember, our motto at Shasta Gas Propane is, our customers are warm friends. We will treat you like friends this winter and do our best to help you through this high price winter. Give us a call at 365-3793. That's 365-3793.
Slow down.
Hi, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt. My chiropractic and nutrition practice in downtown Reading has been helping people feel better for over 20 years. We pride ourselves in really listening to our patients and then tailoring a program of nutrition, chiropractic care, massage, and exercise that's just right for you. The results can be dramatic. Call 244-7873. That's 244-7873. Thank you.
Thinking about starting a new career or upskilling for the career you have right now? It's never too late to start at Shasta College. Late start classes and 8-week compressed classes are still available. Reskill for those new jobs that are emerging in Shasta County. Find out today about their veterans programs and free tuition. All of this at Shasta College. Go to shastacollege.edu.
A jewel of the North State, a place we love to go and love being members.
The view, the best in the North State, from the restaurants, meeting rooms, and of course on the award-winning 18-hole golf course, Riverview Golf and Country Club. It's the place to belong.
Go in and meet the friendly staff today. Go to their website at riverviewgolf.net and find out about their introductory memberships.
Riverview Golf and Country Club, corporate, social, tennis, fitness, and golf. Get it all. Become a member.
It's affordable and fun. Riverview Golf and Country Club.
North State Now is a magazine formatted show at 6 p.m. every Thursday night. The first Thursday is yours truly, Linda Bott, featuring what's going on in our town. The second Thursday is hosted by Michelle Slade, featuring heroes of the North State. The third Thursday is hosted by none other than James Masada and Rhonda Alvey from Enjoy the Magazine and Enjoy the Store. Our newest edition is the fourth Thursday of the month, Women of Vision. That's North State Now, Thursday at 6 p.m., also streaming on KCNR 14.
All aboard! Haas Farms is now open, and it's family night fall fun for the whole family with a kids' roller coaster, go-karts and bumper cars, pony rides, little bug playland and petting zoo, zip lines and pumpkin cannons. Jump on the Haas Express Railroad train and cruise around the orchard. Family night is every Thursday with free general admission thanks to Sinorama. Haas Farms is now open for all the fall fun and food. Haas Kettle Corn, hot dogs, Moe's Pizza, plus beer and wine for the 21 and over. All haunted attractions are open every Friday and Saturday. The Field of Screams, the Sinister Workshop, and the Zombie Slayer paintball excursions. Come blast some zombies on the Zombie Slayer rides. Special thanks to sponsors Above Board Construction and Roofing, Reading Heating and Air, Sinorama, Reading Harley-Davidson, and Only One Benji. All tickets are being sold online this year, so for complete pricing and a schedule of events, get online to HawesFarms.com. That's HawesFarms.com.
I'm celebrating local heroes. Tune in the second Thursday each month at 6.05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now. I'm Michelle Slade. During North State Now, we will speak with your neighbors, friends, family, and community members who give back, not to be recognized, but because it's the right thing to do. During these conversations, we will learn what truly makes our community and the people in it. Join me the second Thursday of each month at 6.05 p.m., right after the news, for Heroes of the North State on North State Now.
Founded in 1995, GI Pathology is the only physician-owned laboratory in the United States dedicated solely to the practice of gastrointestinal and liver pathology. The company provides the highest quality GI pathology diagnosis made exclusively by one of our fellowship-trained gastrointestinal and liver pathologists. GI Pathology delivers results to its Northern California client base within an industry-leading 24 hours. Call 888-2-GI-PATH or go to www.gipath.com for more information.
It's a bright new day. The sun is shining. The birds are singing. And there's never been a better day to try Mount Shasta spring water. Hi, I'm Bob the Drop. I come from a protected spring at the base of Mount Shasta. I'm bottled at the source. It doesn't get more cool and refreshing than that. And it's delivered right to your door. Yep, pure and simple. Naturally, the best. Start your bright new day by calling 1-800-922-6227 to order some of the best tasting water on the planet. Mount Shasta spring water.
Hi, this is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home, too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
When a unicorn is slain, men have destroyed again the image of beauty that they seek. Nicholas Stewart Gray.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
October is our favorite month because we both really like Halloween. So for this October, we decided to take on the topic of monsters, creatures, things that go bump in the night.
We have been fairly academic over the summer and much of the spring. We wanted to have a little fun with this series. So we are starting with the brightest monsters that we can think of, the wholesome, the good ones. And then we are ending with the darkest monsters of all, the scary ones. As we get closer to Halloween, we're going to have more and more fun in this regard.
Yes. So let's get into today's topic. Monsters associated with good, with light, with purity. Because monsters aren't all evil, dangerous, and out to kill us. The definition of monster is usually just kind of an unusual creature outside of the norm.
Something that's been affected by magic in some way.
And unicorns fit that definition. The oldest reference was in the 4th century AD by a Greek physician. I don't even want to try to say his name. But that physician described unicorns as a wild ass as large as a horse with a white body, a red head, and dark blue eyes. The horn was about a foot and a half long, and it was red, white, and black. There really isn't any modern description of a unicorn that fits this.
I think when it started getting associated with purity, that was when all things that were good and wholesome were also associated with the color white in Europe, versus evil was dark and black. So I think they moved it toward the white. So our traditional image of a unicorn now is closer to all white, somewhat sparkly.
That description came around in about the 12th century AD. That's when they tried to bring the mythological lore of Greek and Roman beliefs into Christianity. Here's the weird thing, though. They, at that time in the 12th century, were described about the size of a goat. So small, little things, instead of a wild ass as large as a horse.
And along with that image of purity was that a unicorn would only come to a chaste virgin.
A lot of these themes are in the old movie, Legend, that has Tom Cruise, Tim Curry, and a couple of unicorns. Weird show. But it has that kind of theme to it of unicorns are associated with sexual purity.
I mentioned the horn being sort of not only what makes a unicorn unique and sort of by definition a unicorn, but that also tends to be where a lot of the magic is held in this magical creature. And it turns out that they actually bought and sold unicorn horns at one point during medieval Renaissance time.
They were used a lot in the medieval times in alchemical pursuits as a way to cure poison, to identify poison. At least that's their belief. But what were these unicorn horns? In reality?
Narwhal horns. It turns out they thought that the Vikings were particularly good at hunting unicorns because they came up with all sorts of unicorn horns. And to give you an idea of how much a horn was worth in that time period, there are records of people trading an entire castle for a unicorn horn. So the Vikings are like, narwhal horns.
They kind of look like unicorn horns.
Lop them off, bring them down. Hey guys, can I have a castle? And they did this, not once, not twice, but for 5 centuries.
Yeah. So great. So Queen Elizabeth in the 1570s had a unicorn horn. She drank out of a unicorn horn cup, and it was actually a narwhal horn. I love the history of unicorns. But it's not just in Western culture that a unicorn-type creature is associated with purity. A lot of Asian cultures have a creature similar to the unicorn. It's often called the Asian unicorn or the Chinese unicorn, but it's called in Chinese the Kilin, or in Japanese the Kirin. I'm really sorry. I'm going to be butchering some of these pronunciations. I am trying my best.
I first learned it as a Kirin, K-I-R-I-N, which is the Japanese version of this. But they will occasionally be portrayed as having two different horns, but their manes will be going straight up in this, like, magical, defying gravity kind of thing.
And instead of being a normal horse coat that's fur, it a lot of the times is scaly. They're almost a dragon mixed with a unicorn look in the sculptures and in the art.
But they were definitely associated with goodness. They were sometimes depicted as flying simply because they didn't want to harm anything, even a blade of grass.
Another thing associated with this is it represents both male and female elements. The name itself is a split between male and female. You have the Ki, which is male, Lin, which is female. That pattern also shows up with another Chinese-based creature associated with purity, and this is the phoenix.
Now, the word phoenix actually comes from Mediterranean, the Phoenicians, but what we're talking about is the bird creature that gets reborn in fire.
So in Chinese, the name is Feng Wang. Again, the Feng represents male, Wang represents the female. But you also have bases in, like Lee said, the Mediterranean. You have some bases of a similar creature in Egyptian mythology. We just kind of combine and call it all the phoenix now because that's what's become popularized.
Now, for the most part, what comes to mind when I'm thinking phoenix is Harry Potter, where you've got the big bird that's about the size of a peacock, long, beautiful tail, mostly red with highlights of gold throughout it. Some portray it more as an eagle, especially I think the Native American styles of that kind of character in their culture. They tend to be songbirds, as well as creatures that either when they die, they turn into ash, or they must be born from the fire in some way.
And in Christian traditions, the phoenix has become associated with Christ and the resurrection of Christ. You have Islamic traditions that have brought in the phoenix, that they see the phoenix as created by God to have all perfections. And throughout all of it, it is the rebirth, the immortality, the continuing to live and grow in perfection.
A lot of mythological creatures across the world have a lot of similarities. We're going to notice that throughout this whole series. There's a version of whatever. There's a water elemental here and a djinn here and the nymph here. There are similarities because we come up with ideas based on the world around us. The next creature we're going to talk about is based on something we all see, but not on this world itself.
While many of us grew up seeing a man on the moon, ancient traditions don't see a person. They see a rabbit.
This one was a new one for me when we were researching the different creatures for this.
So you have essentially two separate parts of the world, the Asian area and the Indigenous America area, that came up with their own stories for why there is a rabbit on the moon. But all of them tend to be associated with prosperity, fertility, life, purity.
Rabbits and fertility going hand in hand is not exactly a new concept.
So in the Chinese and other Asian cultures, the moon rabbit is seen as a companion to the moon goddess. And this is the version that creates the antidotes, the elixirs, the herbs for the immortals.
Another story from the Cree Nation in Northern America tells the story of a rabbit that hitched a ride to the moon by hanging onto the legs of a crane, which is why they get all long.
The rabbit just wanted to ride the moon, so it hitched a ride with a crane.
That makes perfect sense.
Yeah. That one in particular explains why you can see a rabbit on the moon and why the crane's legs are so long.
In Mayan culture, the rabbit is also associated with their moon goddess, and they're frequently shown side by side.
Very much like the Chinese background. In Aztec traditions, the god Quetzalcoatl was once living as a human on Earth and thought he would die with no food or water during a long journey, and a rabbit offered himself to the god. As a reward, Quetzalcoatl put the rabbit's image on the moon for people to remember her.
The last critter I wanted to just briefly mention is the caladrius, which is Roman, and it's an animal that's a bird associated with healing, and it was said to arrive in a king's window. I just thought it was an interesting one to kind of toss into the mix.
So the thing with purity is it's not limited to just animals. We talked about the animals. You can also look into plants, such as the world tree and the lily. Both of those in earth cultures very associated with purity.
And plants as monsters are just kind of fun anyway.
So this whole month is going to be us giving you starting points for your research, because we want to equip you with tools to find interesting things, things that you won't always see.
Or even make up your own monsters, especially if you're doing fantasy or sci-fi, something that doesn't take place on Earth. Making up your own monsters is part and parcel to the world-building process.
And that way you can write your book the way you want it to be, because we should always be
writing selfishly.
If you have a question or comment for our hosts or a topic you'd like us to cover, send us an email at writingroots@aspenhousepublishing.com or find us on Facebook by searching for Aspen House Publishing.
Yet the deepest truths are best read between the lines and, for the most part, refuse to be written. Amos Bronson Alcott.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses. And today we're talking about one of my favorite things in the writer's toolbox.
Our topic is subtext. It's those things between the lines, the things that are implied. The things that we've talked about in the past when we tell you about world building and backstory, that is subtext. Subtext adds depth to your characters, to your settings, to your world, to your dialogue, to everything about writing. Which is why when we talk about making your outline or developing your world, developing your characters, that you know so much more about all the characters that you aren't putting in the book, so that your knowledge can be written in subtext. It's those things that you can imply by looking and showing he sees a dog and his muscles tighten and moves to the other side of the street, his breath quickens. So you can imply, yes, he is afraid of dogs and there is a story there, without having to explain the story in a page and a half of useless backstory.
I would say this is a good litmus test for a skilled writer. Is there subtext in the moment? We spoke about this during our Diagnosis Writer series over the summer when we focused on dialogue. A lot of what we said was take stuff out of the quotation marks because then you're moving it to subtext and it becomes a more interesting read.
How do you write something without writing it?
One of the ways you can do it is your character probably has a tell. Every time he lies, he runs his fingers through his hair. And then one of the characters can point it out to another one, hey, you ran your fingers through your hair, I bet you're lying. That happens at the beginning of your story. The reader is informed of this particular detail. Now throughout the rest of the story, every time he runs his fingers through his hair, we know he's lying. Then there's this element of depth to the story because it's not only what the truth is of the moment, but what he wants the other characters to believe the truth of the moment is. One of my favorite examples of establishing subtext is from the more modern version of Italian Job. There's this saying between several of the characters that the word fine stands for freaked out, insecure, neurotic, and emotional. Oh, how are you doing? Oh, I'm fine. I'm pretending to be okay, but I'm really freaked out, insecure, neurotic, and emotional. There's an elegance and an artistry to how they use such a common word in that story because they defined it to have a bunch of subtext attached to it.
So here's the danger of subtext. Say you establish something like that, and then you have a time later that they are using I'm fine literally. Suddenly things are lost in translation to the reader, because they're thinking that it's attached to all the subtext, when really you just kind of thoughtlessly threw in, I'm fine.
Your editor will point this out to you, saying, is this what you intended? Because you could have intended, he's freaked out, insecure, neurotic, and emotional. But if you didn't, and you didn't do anything with it, the editor is going to go, hey, this needs to be a different word.
Another use for subtext is to get your readers thinking about the book when they're not reading. This is one of the reasons I love Brandon Sanderson's books. There is so much subtext. Enough subtext that I can reread the book multiple times and still learn something new every time that I had missed before. And when I'm not actively reading, I'm thinking about those little details, those little elements about the stories, the characters, the nuances that just fill the books. That is probably why they're so long.
This bit of detail is especially useful at the end of a chapter because that's what will get people thinking about it while they're driving, when they should be paying attention in school, when they're in the shower. These things, when their mind wanders, if it's wandering to you, goody. That's part of the goal. You want them engaged in your story and thinking about it when they aren't actively reading the book. Subtext is also really good for getting your reader to be thinking in two ways at once. If you're familiar with film, that's called a split screen, where two different things are happening at the same time. Having that subtext established will help your readers understand a lot more of the moment in a lot less acreage on the page. A lot less time spent. We understand what one character is interpreting is different than what another character is interpreting because we know he's lying.
There are a couple of times, especially in writing, where subtext is very important. One of the first ones is when characters are lying. You rarely want to just come out and say, it was a lie. So you want to have those tells, those little nuances that show that without having to say it.
Unless, of course, you have that character who just goes, I don't believe you. They'll just call him out on it. But that is a character choice. And the reader should understand why the character is saying that. Because the reader understands the subtext of the situation. Another type of story where you need to have a lot of subtext is, of course, the mystery. Because everyone is looking at all of the other characters and going, did this person commit the murder? Or did this person steal the jewels? Or whatever. Every single character is being addressed with a little bit of subtext because the reader is trying to figure it out.
You also want to have enough subtext in your mysteries so that your readers feel satisfied at the end of the book. Especially with murder mysteries, where it's a whodunit, you want the reader to be able to pick up on little subtleties here, little subtleties there, that lead them to, by the end of the book, having a pretty good guess about who the bad guy is. And that is all done in subtext.
Another great use of subtext comes with introverts.
They're not going to be blatant about their emotions. So you need the subtleties of subtext when you have a character who is an introvert, speaking as an introvert.
Subtext is the path you take as an author to make sure it's believable for your readers.
You also want subtext when you have characters that are falling in love. This one is difficult for me, because when it comes to relationships and emotions, I'm pretty straightforward. So writing a subtle falling in love over time romance is not easy. But this can help your readers feel emotionally connected. They can feel like they're falling in love at the same time without being beaten over the head with it.
One of my favorite moments in the Jack Reacher series is when Reacher has been friends with and commanding over this woman who is incredibly strong, incredibly powerful. She hates being touched. There's one moment when they're in a life and death situation. They know one of them is probably going to die tomorrow unless everything happens perfectly, which of course it does. In a time when he would have slept with anyone else, he didn't. He respected her and he didn't touch her, but she reached out and put her hand on his for like 4 seconds and then walked away and went into her room. But that was the first time after like 20 years of being friends, the first time they had physical contact. And there was so much subtext in the emotions of that moment that I just loved it so much.
Subtext is also fun when you need something to sound ominous or to carry a second meaning, like the example from the Italian Job of I'm fine.
If I have a character who is bleeding out and the mother figure is holding him in her arms and she goes, everything's going to be okay. You know, as a reader, everything is not going to be okay.
Another word that carries a lot of subtext is goodbye.
If you watch a fair amount of TV, pay attention to when they end a phone call with goodbye. That feeling, that sinking in your gut, that's intentional by the writers. Of course, when a character is lying for the sake of someone's emotional status, oh, I'm just kidding.
They're not. They said it for a reason. They're not actually kidding. There's a bit of truth behind every just kidding.
Oh, I don't care.
Yeah, they do.
They wouldn't bring it up if they didn't.
Yeah. Or, I don't know, how many times have you met a kid where you ask them what happened and they go, I don't know.
There is plenty of subtext in all of these phrases to throw in. But use them intentionally because your reader will infer something that you might not have meant to imply.
If you have more questions about the use and what subtext is, look up actors talking about subtext. They have to deal with this a lot because screenplay writers write the text and then the actors have to act the subtext. And as the writer, you are kind of both. You need to write the text, imply the subtext in a way that your readers can latch onto it and live it like an actor would.
So if something feels wrong in the story that you're writing, try implying as much of it as you can with subtext and then bringing it back to literal. Because that will give you a much richer story. Instead of him saying, I don't want to go fight the dragon, he can hesitate in putting his armor on, and he can go, well, we could always fight the dragon tomorrow. You can start implying all of these things with subtext if you're feeling that your story is falling a little flat.
A lot of the time, you just want to make it smaller. Go down onto a smaller level, which we will be talking about in a week.
But until then,
write selfishly.
If you have a question or comment for our hosts or a topic you'd like us to cover, send us an email at writingroots@aspenhousepublishing.com or find us on Facebook by searching for Aspen House Publishing.
Then Goliath, a Philistine champion from Gath, came out of the Philistine ranks to face the forces of Israel. He was over 9 feet tall. He wore a bronze helmet, and his bronze coat of mail weighed 125 pounds. 1 Samuel chapter 17.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Essis. And today we are talking about basically just people, but magically bigger people.
That would be the giants. Now, we're not talking about Andre the Giant giants, not people who are just incredibly tall. We are talking about actual mythical creatures, legends, tales of races of tall people.
Across the world, a lot of cultures show tall people as powerful people. I believe there are two different Shinto emperors who are reported to have been more than 10 feet tall. These huge giant people, literally very tall, makes them very powerful to see. So at first sight, if your hero is encountering a giant, they can be very intimidated without even talking to or encountering physically.
So when we're talking about these mythical giants, the biggest thing about them in most legends is that they're basically people, but big. They are sometimes slower, less intelligent, but always strong.
And I've found across my different studies of giants around the world, cannibalism is something that we see a lot of, or at least eating humans in some way. You know, grind your bones for bread kind of a mantra. We see that in a couple of different giant stories around the world.
I have a hard time siding with Jack on the Jack and the Beanstalk story. What would you do if somebody invaded your house and stole your stuff?
Probably exactly the same thing.
Maybe not eat them, but, you know.
Maybe smush them.
Yes. So let's get into some examples of giant or large, intimidating, strong creatures. Of course, you have your trolls and your ogres and your orcs.
And the Urukai, which are important.
Urukai!
A lot of the references to giants are an alternate race, similar to elves and dwarves, where they are human-like, but not. They aren't exactly gods. They aren't demonic in any way. They're mostly just a different kind of people.
In Norse mythology, you have the Jotuns.
And, to be clear, the Avengers mythology as well.
Of course. The frost giants from Jotunheim are very based on this race of giants in Norse mythology.
There was a carving that was dated to about the 10th century AD of, I'm not going to try to pronounce her name because I'm going to butcher it, but one of the Jotun riding a dog like a horse, might have been a wolf, and she had like reins on it, but the reins were made of snakes. It was a very interesting depiction of, because most of the time when we see giants, we don't see them using tools in that kind of a sophisticated way. It's mostly like a club and smash Harry Potter in the bathroom.
If you want to look that up, I believe the pronunciation is Hyrokin. It's Hyrrokkin.
And of course, heading south to the Middle East, the Judeo-Christian history, we have the Philistines, which our opener was referencing, these gigantic warrior-type people.
Even if you aren't super familiar with the Judeo-Christian beliefs, you likely have heard the term Goliath. You've heard that and know that it references a giant, a huge human that is not easily defeated. So if we want to go down under to Australia, there is an oral tradition of a giant known as Crooked Mick.
If you're listening from the U.S., you probably know who Paul Bunyan is. Crooked Mick is like Paul Bunyan, but cooler. Not only does he like chop down stuff and shear sheep and such, but he makes great pies, apparently.
Not only are his pies good, but they are light, so light that a gust of wind can carry them away. And not only are pies getting carried away, if he kicks a crocodile, he can send it to the moon. Sorry, I'm having a really hard time keeping a straight face during this. I love this, and it's just so much fun. That you've just got this, like, Australian bushman that's going out there kicking crocodiles and baking pies.
And generally doing everything that, you know, humans do, but way cooler. So you want to look that one up? That's Crooked Mick. And that's more legend than, like, people believed he actually existed. I mean, obviously, spurned from somewhere.
Again, much like Paul Bunyan.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you have a giant that is super familiar because of its prominence in Greek and Roman tradition, and that's the Cyclops.
He's also familiar because he's the dude with one eye. Which is interesting because most of the depictions I see of the Cyclops, he has the holes in the face in a normal where humans would have eyes, but they're just sort of skinned over, and then he has a third eye at the top of the center of the forehead. I always thought that was weird. It wasn't like they were, like, merged, you know?
I'm just picturing the Cyclops and Hercules, the Disney animated version, where it's just, like, one big eye that's, like, half his face in the middle of his forehead. He has a very tall forehead as a result.
Most of the ones we've talked about so far are enemies of humans in some way. They're hunting them, they're smashing rocks and trying to kill the normal everyman.
Except for Crooked Mick, he's saving them from the crocodiles.
Okay, that's fair. I am talking about the Gentile, I believe it's pronounced. These are a race of giants found in the northern parts of Spain, close to where it meets France in that little bay there. They existed and they basically just hung out with the humans, and they were really known for their ability to throw rocks. And that's how a bunch of little islands off the coast were formed. But they were said to have lived alongside the Basque people at one point.
They were also said to have invented metallurgy, the saw, and grew the first wheat, and then taught the humans how to farm.
Most of them disappeared when the comet flew across the sky around the same time that Christ was born. That was sort of a harbinger for them to go, okay, it's bedtime, and they basically just went and lived under a mountain.
There was one that was said to have remained, known as Olentzero, O-L-E-N-T-Z-E-R-O, and he's said to appear at Christmas and is reproduced as a straw doll.
And of a lot of the giants we find, these ones are furry, they're hairier. Until we get into more modern mythology and cryptozoology.
Fun cryptozoology. If we want to go a little coastal islander, in Fijian mythology, there is a giant who was so large that his teeth looked like they were burning logs. And that is why his name is Flaming Teeth.
Very original. So he basically tortured the humans in the village for so long that a bunch of warriors went, lured him under a big rock, and then pushed it over on him. He died, and his teeth were brought back to the village, which brought fire to the humans.
Fascinating.
we all have some sort of this is how humans got fire story, I think.
And it's never, hey, we boof two rocks together and went, ooh, look, fire. And then if we go to Eastern Asian cultures and mythologies, the Hindu and Buddhist cultures have the Rakshasas, and they were depicted as shape-shifting, fierce-looking, enormous creatures with two fangs that protruded from the top of their mouth.
They have a lot of similarities between them and the modern Bram Stoker version of Dracula, of a lot of the vampire mythology.
Oh.
The shape-shifting, the eating people, especially their blood, needing to be invited into a building. These are all Rakshasa tropes that also appear with vampires, which we'll talk about in three episodes.
Yes.
These ones are a little strange because I didn't necessarily want to put shapeshifters in with giants because giants are naturally large creatures, and these ones can appear humanoid, but they are described as giant, larger than, scarier than humans, and with a lot more magical abilities than most giants we're going to see. And again, eating people is a thing.
So let's look into the literature and references to giants in fiction as we know it today in modern ages.
Of course, from Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels, we have the Brobdingnag, which is a giant, and opposite the Lilliputians, which are the tiny people we talked about a couple episodes ago.
And Gulliver's like the normal-sized person in the middle?
Yep.
Okay. It has been a very long time since I've watched a movie that relates to that, and I've never read the book.
Yeah, it's been a while since I read the book. I didn't really follow most of it. I think I was a little too young for that. But if you're younger and you're looking for it, Roald Dahl has the BFG.
Big Friendly Giant. One of my favorites is actually Fezzik from The Princess Bride, portrayed by Andre the Giant. Absolutely love him. So great. And then the classic example, the Cyclops from Odyssey.
And the last one I just want to touch on, because I think this is how most people are familiar with giants and trolls and half-giants and such, is Harry Potter. We see trolls in the first book, and then one of the closest friends of the main characters is half-giant. They make fun of giant-type people a couple of different times, you know, just point and grunt. It's not that hard to talk their language.
Yeah, and in Harry Potter, the half-giants are especially considered, looked down on as lesser beings because of their mixed race.
So if I'm being plagued by a giant, how do I take it down?
Just make them fall over.
Okay. Crushing under their own weight. We see this a couple of different ways. We see that, of course, in Mickey Mouse had some of that. And I think the most classic version is Jack and the Beanstalk.
When he makes the giant fall off the beanstalk, chops it down while the giant's climbing down. Again, Jack invaded his house. What else was he supposed to do?
She's not going to let this die.
I'm not. Another thing when it comes to giants is the eyes tend to be vulnerable, especially with your cyclopses. The eyes and the face in general.
And I believe that's how the hero actually defeated the Cyclops, was he drove a spear or a lance into the Cyclops' eye. And then the Cyclops ran around going, nobody stabbed me in the eye, because he had convinced the Cyclops that his name was Nobody.
And in general, you deal with a giant the same way you would deal with a human. They're stronger, they're bigger, but they have the same kind of vulnerabilities. Their anatomy is generally the same. But they may be a little bit more invulnerable to magic.
Of course, you could go with the Princess Bride logic and the Fijian logic.
The moment his head is in view, hit it with a rock!
Seem to work for them. They have fire. And in general, most of the time, you're going to see your heroes be smarter and more agile than your giants. This goes back to your David and Goliath story of, okay, I have a power behind me that you can't take down, so I'm smarter, I'm faster, I'm going to whack you in the head with a rock. Even though I am smaller, I can still beat you.
D&D stats, they have better dexterity.
Yep.
I hope this information has helped you, given a few ideas about introducing a giant character or giant race into your stories. you can play with it. You can have fun with it. Remember, these are mythologies. These are malleable creatures that you can use and play with and do as you will.
And these are an easy one, I think, to slip in because it's not like the Chimera, which we'll talk about next episode, where you have to describe this element and that element and they're going to shoot fireballs and whatever at you because of the specifics of this particular monster. Basically, everyone in your audience goes, giant, right, I have an image of that in my head. I don't need a 3-page description in order to follow the plot.
So go out, create, have fun, put giants into your story, and always
write selfishly.
If you have a question or comment for our hosts or a topic you'd like us to cover, send us an email at writingroots@aspenhousepublishing.com or find us on Facebook by searching for Aspen House Publishing.
You know, it can be difficult to find a trustworthy, knowledgeable, and yet affordable auto repair shop. Advanced Automotive is a second-generation, locally owned, full-service repair shop serving our community since 1993, and one of only 4 AAA-approved auto repair shops in the Reading area. Advanced Automotive has a goal, and it's to keep it simple to have safe, reliable vehicles for our customers and our community. Call or come by to meet the crew who is here to serve you. 244-4423. Advanced Automotive.
By reading a lot of novels in a variety of genres and asking questions, it's possible to learn how things are done, the mechanics of writing, so to speak, and which genres and authors excel in various areas. Nicholas Sparks.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
Our question for today in our continued Frequently Asked Questions series is, how do you know which genre your book is in?
See, the book I'm writing right now has magic, but it also takes place on Earth, and some of the problems are solved by a character falling in love, and most of the stuff that happens is action-based where people are sword fighting and trying to kill each other. So is it fantasy? Is it historical? Is it romance? Or is it action-adventure?
Swords and sorcery.
Which is a subcategory of
fantasy. Which is a subcategory of speculative fiction.
Which is a subcategory of fiction.
So, as you can see, there is a lot of things in genre. But there are a couple of questions that you can ask yourself to help you narrow down what genre your book is in.
Before we get into that, I want to make sure you, our audience, knows why this question is important. Well, I'm not asking this question. I know what genre my book is in. Or I don't care what genre my book is in. It's very dangerous for people who want to be career authors. If all you are doing is writing selfishly, you don't have to worry about genre. You have fun. We'll see you next episode. But if you ever want to sell any of your books, understanding your genre, understanding which shelf the bookstore puts it on, helps sell your book. Because if I am looking for an action-adventure novel and I have to sift through cookbooks, then I'm not going to be as interested.
So if you want to know why you need to know, go back in our archives and search for target audience. We've talked about that before in an episode, I believe, in July. You can also look at our series from last March when we talked specifically about genres. We covered the basic ones, some of the specifics of, you know, cover design and plot of each of those. Today, though, we're not focusing on those aspects. We're just focusing on how to figure out what genre you're in.
Yeah, if you don't know which of March's episodes to look at to make sure it applies to your book, this is the right episode to start on.
So what is the first question that you...
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.